Today's lecture is about construal in language, and I sent you the slides yesterday together with the publication, the published manuscript. So you can always look there for more details, but we'll try to make it as clear as possible during the lecture as well. So as cognitive linguists, you're all familiar with the concept of construal in language. So languages provide different ways to categorize situations, the participants in those situations and the properties of those participants, the relations between those participants. And therefore, speaking often implies a choice. For example, here, between the active and the passive voice. So when you see this picture, you can say that the police arrested a man, or a man was arrested by the police, and either use the active or the passive formulation. Now, as you know, within cognitive linguistics, these, when you have two or more grammatical possibilities for expressing or describing the same situation, then we call this construal. And because of this operation of construal, this operation of construal also highlights that meaning is at least partially made by the speaker. So there is information in the scene, but the way in which you decide to describe it adds an additional layer of information. And in cognitive linguistics, we accept that the choice you make when you describe a scene, so for example, with this picture, whether you took the active or the passive, that reflects the speaker's conceptualization of that scene or of that event. So this links back to the discussion we had yesterday at the end about attention. So very simply put, construal embodies the role that attention plays in language. So experience is so rich that there is no single way to represent the situation linguistically. And the lexical choices that you make, for example, if you have multiple near synonyms at your disposal, the particular one you choose, or the syntactic choices that you make, if, for example, as we will talk soon about the dative alternation, which of the two options you choose also reflect the specific way in which the speaker frames their experience. And it also it's kind of the speaker's commitment to how they want that experience to be shared with their hearer. So language can be seen as a kind of highlighting device that either promotes or demotes the importance or the salience of different cues that are available in the context. And in turn, these choices modulate how the hearers attend to those cues. So the linguistic choices, for example, for the active versus the passive, they reveal the need that the speaker feels to bring one participant rather than the other to the listener's attention. So for example, when we go back to our example, whether you use an active or a passive sentence doesn't change anything about the events that you witnessed. But the active sentence, for example, is said to foreground the agent, while the passive sentence foregrounds the patient. So if you want to draw attention to the police, you will say the police arrested a man. But if you want to draw attention to the man, you could say a man was arrested by the police. And construal is one of the foundational notions in cognitive linguistics. And it has tremendous explanatory power. It's very often invoked in cognitive linguistic analyses of language. But as many other things that we are very fond of and that play an important role in our theory, the notion hasn't really been tested empirically. So this is partially due to the fact that construal is difficult to operationalize. But that also means that most of the research relying on construal are most of these analyses are based on the linguists' intuitions. the analyst's own intuitions about the language data they are looking at. And that, of course, brings us back to the dilemma that I've talked about in the previous two lectures as well. If we want to be cognitively realistic, is it really sufficient to only rely on our own intuitions? But if we go and look for patterns in the data, then we face the other problem that I described. Are the patterns that we find in the data real, meaning, and in particularly, we want to know whether they exist in the mind of language users, and in particular, in multiple minds of language users. So that's basically the preamble to our study on the study on construal that we will be talking about today. As I said, it's a published study. It appeared in Cognitive Linguistics last year. It was collaboration between Petr and me and one of our postdocs, Srdjan Medi-Moritz, who is a psychologist and did a lot of the hands-on work in setting up the experiment and collecting the data. So when we embarked on this study, what we really wanted to find out is whether there was any different mental reality associated with the alternative construals. Construals, the different options linguistically, you know, reflect the different communicative intentions on the part of the speaker. But ideally, they would also evoke different conceptualizations of a situation in the minds of the hearer. And we wanted to see whether these differences in conceptualization went beyond us as individual analysts and were actually attested in a larger population. So if I say as a linguist that the active foregrounds the agent and the passive foregrounds the patient, is that something that only I as a linguist perceive, or is that something that naive, linguistically uneducated speakers of a language also perceive? And as I said, construal is kind of a tricky one to operationalize. It's difficult to think of a way in which we could go and test construal. And we decided to operationalize construal by relying on a different notion, the notion of ception, which goes back to Talmy's writings. And ception is a combination of perception and conception. And it adds, in other words, it adds a visual component to the conceptual component that construal offers. So the question is then, does the linguistic encoding that we perceive or that we see encounter in language, does that affect the way in which events are perceived and conceived by the speakers of a language, so by a larger subsample? And because we went down the path of ception, which adds perception to conception, this made it possible for us to embed our study within a larger framework of studies on visual perception. There is quite a bit of work on language-guided visual perception, and also within the framework of studies on attention. And as I mentioned yesterday, there is work on the circumstances under which attention for a specific aspect of a situation affects grammatical encoding. So what we were interested in our study is what kind of differences in grammatical encoding affect the visual attention for aspects of a situation. So is all grammar created equally, and do all grammatical differences trigger differences in visual attention and encoding, or is this limited to specific types of grammatical phenomena? So basically what we did was introducing methods from studies on scene perception, and these methods typically rely on eye tracking. And I'll talk a little bit more about eye tracking in the following slides. So there is a very old work, like from 1935 already, that looks at the effects of a specific task on how participants view a static scene. So there is this famous study by Yarbus, a Russian psychologist who published it in 1967, who let participants look at a painting. This is called The Unexpected Visitor. It's by Ilya Repin. And he gave his participants different tasks when he asked them to look at at this same scene. So this is, I think this is the father who returns to his family after many years of absence. And you see that they're all, you know, very surprised. Some are happy to see him. And it's this scene that the participants were asked to view, but the task that they were given for each viewing was different. And while they were viewing this scene under this different task conditions, Yarbus recorded their eye movements. And I believe he did this in a very cruel way with some kind of matches attached to their eyes. So they couldn't do the task for very long. This was a precursor of modern eye tracking. So what you see in the top right panel is the way in which the participants viewed the scene when they were allowed to examine the scene freely. So they were just given the picture and told to, you know, view the painting. And what you see on the left-hand side is the viewing pattern that emerged when the participants were asked to scan the picture to later be able to assess the material circumstances of the family. Next is the viewing pattern that emerges when the participants were asked to view the scene with the purpose of, or with the aim of, estimating the ages of the people in the picture. Next is the viewing pattern that emerged when participants were asked to view the scene to later guess what the family was doing before the unexpected visitor arrived. That's how they looked at the scene when they were asked to have a good look and remember what clothes the people in the picture were wearing. The bottom left one is the pattern that emerges when they were asked to view the picture with the aim to remember the position of the people and the objects in the room. And the last one is the pattern that emerges when they were asked to view and then estimate how long the unexpected visitor had been away from the family. And as you can see, even though the image they were viewing is the same each time, the instructions that they were given very much affected how they viewed this very same scene. And that is also, in essence, what we want to see when we study construal. So does the way in which a scene is described alter the way in which people look at the scene? So as I mentioned yesterday, attention is a huge topic. When you look at the Oxford Handbook of Attention, it contains at least 1500 pages. What is striking is that there is no single definition that all researchers of attention can agree on. And what's even more interesting is that in this Oxford Handbook of Attention, there was not a single mention of language. And attention and language have been studied to some extent, but this topic has remained quite marginal within linguistics. So the one thing you may be familiar with is Tomlin's work from 1995 on the fish film, where he designed a simple way to see whether a visual perception and linguistic expression, or how they relate. So he showed his participants a little movie with fishes, so to speak, and then he would check how the participants would describe what's going on in the scene. So when he put an arrow above the dark fish, and then on the third line asked them to describe what was happening, participants were more likely to make the dark fish the main participant in the event and use a passive. So the gray fish was eaten by the white fish. Whereas in another scene, he would put the little arrow above the white fish. Then when the participants came to describing the action, they were more likely to use an active and say the white fish ate the gray fish. And this line of research was carried On by Andrei Myachikov. And probably together, Tomlin and Myachikov are the two people within cognitive linguistics who've done most work on attention and language and have also based their work on empirical research. So they've taken a psycholinguistic approach to these questions. And the questions they've focused on answering is how visual and linguistic information is integrated during sentence production. There's another line of research that has looked at attention and language, and that's work on language comprehension, which originated within the psycholinguistic tradition. So their concerns are slightly different than that of cognitive linguists, and they look, for example, at structurally ambiguous sentences or processing difficult references or what happens when you use structural or semantic priming. And most of these studies are situated within theories that look into incremental processing and also the role of prediction in language comprehension. So concerns that are different from the concerns that cognitive linguists have. So to get back to our question, we wanted to determine what kind of difference in grammatical encoding affects attention for specific aspects of the situation. Or in other words, do individuals construct the same mental image or a different mental image when they process the same event but described by two different sentences or two different constructional options? We were not, as very often is the case, linguists aren't really interested in processing in real time. We're more interested in the results of processing or the knowledge that is required for processing or what processing can tell us about these things. So we didn't look at processing in real time. There is another methodological reason for this choice that I will get back to a little bit later, but we looked at comprehension. So that's kind of processing, but with a little bit of delay. As I mentioned yesterday, research in memory has shown that it's probably not a good idea for our brains to encode every experience in minute detail. And the assumption exists that what the brain encodes in memory is actually the gist of what has happened. So that's also why we looked at comprehension rather than processing in real time, because we want to see what actually gets encoded into memory. And that will remind you of this table or this figure that I showed yesterday. So on the one hand, you have experience. On the other hand, you have memory, but attention plays a really important role. Experience is too rich for us to process and register. And attention then plays a role of focusing our attention on specific aspects of the experience. And as cognitive linguists, we're interested in the role that language plays in this focusing of attention. So there are two hypotheses that you can formulate when you embark on this type of study. And there's one hypothesis that you can formulate, but you can formulate it in a strong way and in a weak way, so to speak. So the strong version of our hypothesis would be that construal completely determines conceptualization. And if that would be the case, then, for example, the order in which the participants in an event are mentioned would completely determine the scan path that the participants display. If we go with a weak version of the hypothesis, it would not be the case that construal determines conceptualization, but that it merely affects conceptualization, and it doesn't necessarily determine the scan path, but it modulates, for example, the scan path. And at the end of this lecture, you'll see which of those two versions of the hypothesis we found evidence for. So, to collect data for this study, we relied on eye tracking, and more specifically, we ran a visual world eye tracking study in which we used the eye tracker to record the gaze of the subject as they viewed scenes and listened to linguistic descriptions of the scenes. So in the visual world paradigm, typically the images that are used and the setup that is used is very artificial. We made a change there and we moved to naturalistic images. I'll show you an example on the next few slides. Of course, that complicated our design significantly. So we had to cut back on reality in a different way, so to speak. And the sentences that we used were not sentences extracted from a corpus, but they were constructed sentences. So we wanted, we have a more natural viewing situation than a linguistic situation, so to speak. But having both would have complicated matters too much. There would have been too much variation that we would have had to control for statistically. So typically in a visual world paradigm, the screen that the participant see looks at follows. So you typically have four images, and then participants hear a statement, and the eye tracker records how their eyes move towards the correct part of the image, so to speak. So you have a frog, you have a mat, and you have a box. And then, for example, you would say the frog, and then they would look at the top left, and then is, and then they might not know whether they're going to go to the mat or the box. And then as soon as they hear on, they move to the lower right pattern, because the sentence clearly going to be the frog is on the mat and not the frog is in the box. But this is a very artificial situation. And it records, what they do is record eye movements as they occur. We move to a more realistic type of figure. So for example, for our date of alternation, we had the this image, and then the sentence was the boy gave the girl flowers. And we would then record the eye movements as they happened after the participants had heard the sentence. We manipulated the order of presentation, so the order in which the participants were exposed to the image or the audio. So in other words, we had initially participants were asked to view the image only. So they were shown the picture and they were just asked to look at the picture. And we did that so that we could record their default viewing pattern. As you will remember from Jarbus's study that I showed you, people look differently at images depending on the task they are given. And we just wanted to know how they would look at image without any instructions, without any linguistic description, to get a default viewing pattern, but also to eliminate the effect of any salient image properties. Of course, if you take naturalistic images, it may be that, for example, the girl has very fancy hair, or the boy wears funny shoes, and this is something that attracts the attention of the participants, even though linguistically that's of course not interesting. And then in the next phase, we had sound to image condition, where that we introduced because the changes in viewing pattern there would be due to construal. So we first let them listen to a linguistic description of a scene, then we showed the image depicting the scene, and then we checked whether one linguistic description versus another description changed the viewing pattern. So first the linguistic stimulus was, you know, the length was between 2 and 4 seconds, and then they had 3.5 seconds to scan the image. This was also consecutive. So first they'd heard the sentence, then they viewed the scene. And that's because we wanted to get at the gist. So what do they remember of the linguistic description that then still influences how they view the scene? In total, we had 60 participants. So I'll show you what it looked like. So in the first block, which was our naturalistic image viewing, they were shown 48 images. So if you go from the top left to the bottom right, so first they were asked to focus on a dot in the middle of the screen for 500 milliseconds, so half a second. And then they were given 3.5 seconds to scan an image. Again, they focused on their eyes on a dot in the middle of the screen, and then they were shown the next image and so on. So 46 images in total. And then there were two blocks where they listened to a sentence and then moved to viewing the image. So there were 96 sentences followed by images. And of course, the sentences and the images were matched. So the sentences described what was going on in the image they would see next. Each image is described in two ways, but each participant only sees one option per block. So they're not given both the active and the passive description of an image. So for example, if you heard the sentence, the police arrested the man in your second block, then you heard the sentence, the man was arrested by the police only in your third block. So this is what it looked like for them. They heard the police arrested the man, then they were shown an image that fit with that description. Then they moved to the next sentence, the girl passed the child the ball, then they were shown an image that fit that description. And then in the following block, they were given the other option of the version of the construal. So then they would hear the man was arrested by the police and they were shown again the same picture. The girl passed a ball to the child and they were shown again the same image. As linguists, we like not to just focus on one specific type of structure, but we like to include a variety of things, if only to see whether the result of our manipulation is the same across different structures, so to speak. And for this experiment, we selected a cline of construal operations, so to speak. So we had prepositions, voice, and dative. The prepositional alternation or the location alternation is a textbook example of what has been called perspective or prominence, and it clearly implements this figure ground idea from Gestalt psychology that's important in cognitive grammar. So for the preposition construction condition, we had sentences like the shelves are over the desk, and then the other version would be the desk is under the shelves. Our second alternation was the voice alternation. And different from this location alternation, the voice alternation is not about a spatial relation between two things, but it's about relations between animate agents in an event. So the voice alternation, in a way, implements a figure ground distinction in a scene with animate participants. There is a lot of research on the voice alternation, so that was interesting for us as well to have that as background. So here we had sentences like, the nurse vaccinated the patient, and then the passive would be the patient was vaccinated by the nurse. And then we had finally the dative alternation, which is a very intricate alternation with respect to perspective or prominence, because it leaves the relation between the two interacting animate beings in the scene unaffected. And instead it focuses on the relation between the object and the recipient. So you have the option of saying the boy gave the girl a flower or the boy gave a flower to the girl. In both cases, the boy gives something to the girl, but the position between the object and the recipient is what changes. And we expected the strongest effects of construal on perception and therefore on conception for preposition and the weakest effect for dative. In a sense, it's similar to saying, you could expect this also because it's taken linguists an awful amount of effort to pinpoint the differences between the two dative constructions, whereas it would be straightforward for anyone to explain the difference between the two preposition constructions. Now, when participants view these scenes and you track their gaze with the eye tracker, then the important variable, so to speak, or an important piece of information is dependent on what is called an interest area. And an interest area is what it says. It's the area of the figure or of the image that is of interest to you. And you will remember in typical visual world paradigm studies, you have four images presented in each of the four corners of the screen. So you just draw a box around them and you consider each image to be an area of interest. But of course, because we used realistic images, this was much harder. We couldn't really draw boxes around maybe the man or the agent. And then you see that there's a lot of overlap where their hands are. So what we did is we defined our interest areas empirically. So we took data from 10 participants and had exported heat maps from the eye tracker. And then we used freehand drawing to capture the areas of interest. So for example, as you can see, these green and red blobs are heat maps. So the more red the part of the images, that means that more participants have looked at that point in the image, so to speak. So we then used the larger, the greenish blobs to delineate our areas of interest. So for example, we would say that the face here of the policeman is the agent, and then the face of that other guy is the patient. And then the thing that's happening in the middle was our interest area for the event. Now, a further note on experimental design is that we had to allocate those interest areas to parts of the image. And these allocations have to stay constant throughout the analysis. So here too, we took some decisions. So in the preposition construction, we had two interest areas, and interest area A was the easily movable element and interest area B was the less easily movable element. So for example, when you had the poster and the bed, the poster, the movable element would be interest area one, and the bed, the immovable object, would be interest area two. And for voice, we decided that interest area A would be the agent, B would be the patient, and C would be the action. So in the scene where you have a nurse vaccinating a policeman, the nurse, not a rectangle, of course, because we did this based on heat maps, would be one, the policeman would be two, and then three would be the event of the vaccination event in the middle. And then for the dative, we had interest area A or one was the agent, B was recipient, and C was the object. So with the boy and the girl and the flower, you would have the boy would be one, the girl would be two, and then in the middle you would have the flower, that would be the third one. Now, for everybody who's ever used eye tracking, knows that when you're done with your experiment and you extract the data, you get an enormous number of variables that you can use. There are easily 100, 150 different variables that you can choose, that you can use. And it is really important to make a choice, a theoretically informed choice beforehand, because otherwise you're just going to go out on a fishing trip and try anything and find, I mean, something will come out as significant, and then you will start writing about that. So we wanted to make an informed choice before starting on the analysis. And we decided on three measures that we would use. So our first measure was what we call order of access. So that is the order in which the viewers accessed each of those interest areas, so to speak, in our images. So do they first look at the policeman? Do they first look at the girl? Do they first look at the flower, etc.? And this is an early measure that captures in which order the participants scan the interest areas. Then the second measure that was of interest to us was the first gaze duration. That's also an early measure. And that's basically a measure of how long it took the participants to look at an interest area when they enter that interest area for the first time. So if you are presented with an image, the first time you look at the policeman, how long exactly do you look at the policeman? And then our third measure is overall gaze duration, which is a late measure, and late measures are typically considered to be in measures that give an indication of how long it takes people to integrate the information that they have collected up to that point. And the overall gaze duration is the time participants or viewers spend looking at a specific interest area in total. So when you look at an image, it's very typical that you don't, for example, think of the nurse and the policeman and the vaccination event. It's very typical when you see that image that first you look, for example, at the nurse, at the policeman, and then you go back to looking at the nurse, and then you look at this, I can't even remember the injection. How can I forget something like vaccination and injection in COVID times? So then you look at the injection, and then maybe you go back to the policeman. So the whole 3.5 seconds that you get to look at an event are kind of divided up over the interest areas of your image in different ways. And this overall gaze duration captures how long you looked at each interest area in total. Okay, so I have set you up for the study. I'd say we can take a break now. Maybe we can be back at 50, and then Petter will talk you through the statistical analysis and the findings for this study.
Okay, so see you in 50.
So in this second part of today's talk or presentation, I will cover analysis and results in greater details. But as Dagmar warned you, or not warned you, just mentioned that to you, that when you're using eye tracking technology, it gives you great flexibility and choice of potential dependent variables. So what you want to, it measures everything, but then what you want to actually analyze given your specific questions and hypothesis. And because it's so rich in data, then very often you also need to do some preparatory steps before you rush into analysis itself. So there are kind of pre-processing steps. For example, what we did, which is more or less common practice, is that you check whether you have information where you have data for your particular questions and your particular targeted analysis. In this case, we didn't register, or the system didn't register saccades into an interest area for about 30% of cases. That doesn't mean that saccades were not, so those rapid eye movements were not present, but they were just not landing within our interest area. And again, just as a reminder, Dagmar showed you those pictures that we used, and we draw interest area around interesting, important objects given the sentence that described the scene. So if I landed outside those area, it was considered to be actually not landing, not into the interest area. So we basically ignored or removed those data points. And again, standard, more or less standard research practice is such that you should not consider very short fixations. If they're, let's say, it's an arbitrary number, but again, good practice says if it would be less than 60 milliseconds, that's very, very short. It's just like almost like erroneous fixation, which you immediately correct and fixate at actual target. And we had about 1% of these cases. We also applied minimal a priori trimming according to a study or a methodological paper that I co-wrote with Harold Bai, where traditional practice is or was such that you delete everything that is, for example, outside 2.5 standard deviation from the average reaction time or whatever. But many authors argue that actually that's not a good practice. In particular, Roger Radcliffe, since he has a theory of reaction time latencies, his drift diffusion model, he also argues for a specific distribution of time latencies in cognitive research more generally. And his model actually is so-called ex-Gaussian, which means that it's a combination of two processes, of two distribution. One is exponential, another one is Gaussian, hence ex-Gaussian. And his claim is, I'm simplifying a little bit, but his claim is that Gaussian part, normal part, is just a noise, but interesting part is actually exponential. This is why if you ever saw a distribution of reaction time latencies, you will see that it has a elongated right tail. So it from your side, it looks like with a long right tail. And his claim is basically that in that tail, so to say, cognitively interesting things are happening, and hence you should not delete them a priori or aggressively. And we kind of follow this advice and follow this practice and argued and explained in more greater detail why a priori trimming, where you only trim out obvious outliers and extreme values and nothing else. So in the end, we have a lot of quality, high quality or good data. So more than 13,000 data points. Different numbers for different construals. So a bit more than 2,500 for prepositions, more than 4,000 or 4,500 for voice, and even more, almost 6,000 data points for dative. Now, again, you should, when you decide about your research question and which of the many available dependent variables from my tracking is the one, the right to answer those questions, you need to make certain decisions, some sort of to explain in principle to yourself what are the foundation of your statistical decisions. And I'm just kind of a great fan of Sir Ronald Fisher. And he was the one who actually was soliciting for a non-mechanical approach to statistics. He claimed, and he criticized other two famous statisticians, Newman and Pearson, saying that statistics should not be a blind mechanical step in your research, but more inferential, more thinking, more probing, modeling, and modeling in kind of in several iterations. So you do something, you look at your data, you think, you say, okay, I need to do this and that, and you make some analytical steps. Then you again think about what you got, and then you make another step. So that was his very much his view on how statistics should be used. So what we decided as the most basic thing is that we had three separate models, one for each construal, because for us there was nothing meaningful to analyze everything in one big pot. If you would think about what that means, there is not much of a theory, neither linguistic or psychological or psycholinguistic theory, to say why would, I don't know, a passive voice would be fixated longer or shorter than noun prepositional phrases. So you actually want to discuss what's within typical construal, one of three of our construals, but not across them, because that's kind of, there is not much rationale to do so. So one thing we said, okay, let's run separate models. Also because partly we had considerable differences in the amount of data across those three construals. We also included, we applied mixed models, including random effects as well, but we cap them only when they're justified. I'm flagging this up because there is a very popular paper by Barr et al. I think the 2000, maybe 12 or 30. If anyone is interested, I can check the exact year. And they claimed, actually that's the central claim, that we should always apply maximum complexity to random part with all kinds of interactions and details. But there is a counter paper to that position who in my opinion convincingly show that this is just a kind of a royal way to overfit your model. So you should never do that. You should only keep what is improving your statistical model in statistical sense. You have a better fit for your data. We also made the decisions about which dependent variables are the one that we want to use. And as Dagmar said, there are plenty of options and more than hundreds of versions and derived dependent variables from eye tracking. That gives you great flexibility to find the right ones, the one that will really address your research questions. Of course, there is another thing that you need to be careful about, because you have so many different dependent variables, you also need to take care about the fact that those might be of different types, and then you need to have appropriate so-called link function, which is something that, to put it simply, is this, what is the assumption of residual variance? If you have time latencies, even in lexical decision or fixation durations and such, you would say, okay, this is Gaussian or normal distribution. But if you have number of fixation, which is count, how many, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, that then you would use Poisson distribution, and you have many other options. So you always need to find appropriate link function to run the right model, so to say. We made use of generalized additive mixed models. So in principle, this is just, let's say, a superclass that includes all other more specific types of statistical models, like linear mixed effect. This one also handles non-linearities in a very efficient way. It also can run a simple ANOVA, simple regression, or multiple regression. So it's kind of a super class that contains all those more specific types of statistical techniques that are typically used in language research. We made use of three dependent variables. One is order of access to interest area, which is kind of probably the most direct way to answer our questions, whether construer are capable to alter, to change the way we will access either a subject or object or more or less movable part of the scene and so on and so forth. And then we included two, temporal variables, which are capturing duration of gaze and total gaze duration. So first, which is typically called just gaze duration, that means the total time of how long your eye spent in this interest area before it left that interest area for the first time. And then the total also includes when you return, it will just sum up all those other later. So this is in the first run, I fixated two or three times, I just sum all those durations in milliseconds. Total fixation is somewhat different. I would sum up also after I return from some other interest area into that one for which I'm taking this measure. We also run two, so we had the preparatory steps for the data, as I said, and then we also run two models as sort of a pre-analysis just to check whether our experimental manipulation was efficient, gave us what we expected, what we assumed when we designed the study. And as Dagmar explained in the first part of the study, we wanted to have naturalistic pictures, and that kind of complicated the scene. So there are plenty of things that you need or should control. And one way to do is also to have this additional checks, kind of pre-analysis, just to have a confirmation there is nothing problematic and your assumptions for your design of this experiment is just fine. First measure that we use and analyze in this kind of pre-analysis is gaze path length. Does length of gaze in total differ? And this is just one example. Depending on the complexity of picture, you can have a longer or shorter gaze. This is what we calculated. If any of those pictures, in particularly within of three targeted controls, is considerably different, that would imply that our design failed, so to say. And then the second one is average pupil size, which is typically considered to show cognitive effort. So again, if we would have very different pupil sizes, that would imply, oh, there were different efforts in cognitive efforts given specifics of the each construal, and that would then imply again your design kind of failed. So you would expect for different material to have different cognitive load. Perhaps you would observe pupil dilation if there is a kind of someone is working difficult mathematical problems and things like that, which would again trigger cognitive effort, and that would be reflected in the size of your pupil. So if any of two control analyses would result in statistical significance within construal, then the experimental control, which we assume that we predicted homogeneous conditions, then it means that experimental control failed. And that was not the case. I would just go briefly through these two graphs. On the left-hand side, you have length of gaze path. On the right-hand side, you have pupil size. As you can see clearly, for each of the three construal, there is almost no differences between the order of presentation, naturalistic, so just picture, and then in preposition you have typical, atypical. Typical is the second canonical prepositional construal, or non-canonical as the third, and then here you have preposition but in different order, first naturalistic, then atypical, then typical. Same for voice, two possibilities. Picture gazing was always the first, and what we systematically manipulated was the order of canonical, let's call it canonical and non-canonical type of or subtype of construal, for voice to active passive, for preposition to, for dative as well too. But as you can see, they are almost, they basically overlaying. You see here a slight difference, but those are non-significant. So we have, as we concluded, this is a strong within construal consistency. We see some downward shorter gaze path length. So a length of gaze becomes shorter and shorter as you repeat the same experience. You hear the sentence, you see the picture, you're kind of getting somewhat more efficient in gazing the picture, but not significantly. Even that was not, so that downward line was non-significant. and the slope was non-significant, and same stands for average pupil size. It was upward, so you see some kind of slightly, you see more of cognitive effort, but not non-significantly so. So again, nothing as probably because people are bored to see the same picture over and over again, and they put some additional cognitive effort to cope with boredom, so to say. So no differences within three types of constructions, and no evidence for any differential interference effect. So our experimental design passed with flying colors, and then off to main analysis. We added one additional statistical control to keep things tight, but at the same time, simple and straightforward, because we had three presentational cycles, so to say, first naturalistic, so picture only, and then either canonical, then non-canonical, or first non-canonical, then canonical. We basically made a so-called dummy variable, canonical first, which would just indicate, yes, you first hear active sentence, then passive, or if it wasn't canonical first, then that meant you heard first passive and then active sentence. Main analysis, as I said, was order of access, and proper adequate link function was ordered categories. So that means that interest area are expected to be A first, then B, then C. So they are ordered, there is an order, but not really a numeric value to any of it. And the question was, does control manipulation alter the order in which I visit interest area? For example, if you have an active sentence, kind of commonsensical prediction would be subjects should be accessed first. But in the case of passive sentence, you could say, well, maybe subjects should be second accessed and object should be accessed first. And this is the base statistical model for very much we also use for all other analysis. So you have your dependent variable here, and then you have a combination of interest area A, B, and C, and category for voice, active, passive, for prepositions, noun phrase, and prepositional phrase, and so on. Canonical first was always in the game just to keep that tight control, whether hearing first more common way, like active sentence, would affect hearing passive afterwards differently than if I hear first passive, that would affect less me hearing active sentence the last. So that's just to have to keep this tight control. And depending, we also included interaction with participants, assuming that maybe some participants, they just might be more sensitive for the situation when they hear first typical construal and then atypical, or vice versa. So we even allow for that kind of flexibility. But those two, canonical first and this additional wrinkle in random effects, was just if statistically proven to be significant. Again, these are just pictures to remind you what they saw and what they hear. So preposition, summary of results, generally speaking, across three conditions, the more movable element A is more likely to be accessed first. Typical formulation appears to align with naturalistic scene viewing. So when they didn't hear any sentence, that was more alike typical formulation than atypical one. An atypical prepositional mode almost kind of neutralized this viewing preference. This is just a summary graph, as you see. So basically, this is typical preposition. This is just naturalistic viewing. These two are more alike than atypical with naturalistic. So this difference is statistically less pronounced than this difference and this difference. So typical doesn't alter much of what you would do just by gazing freely picture. But atypical kind of alters this slightly. Then this is just the, one of the many pictures for voice. And results for voice is such that natural viewing mode, the event is accessed first. And the active voice sentence gives similar pattern of preference, but slightly, again, slightly less pronounced. In a way, kind of similar to what we got with prepositions. And in passive, however, the chance for patient to be accessed first become equal to chance of event to be accessed first. And this is visual. This is exactly what we got for passive. They're almost exactly the same, but you see here this difference in active and even more so pronounced in naturalistic viewing. These are not different. So the tendency is the same with kind of canonical voice construal, and this non-canonical or passive voice alters this in a way, alters probabilities of accessing particular interest area in a particular order. Finally, we have dative. This is just a reminder for you for the picture that they saw. And then summary of results is such that in a natural viewing mode, the probability that the agent or the recipient will be accessed first is significantly higher than for the object. And in dative non-phrase mode, agent, recipient, and object all have equal probability to be accessed first. Prepositional phrase mode, however, gives higher chances to agent than to recipient or the object. This is the result. So here, this difference is more pronounced than this difference. And you see also that here, these two are agent and recipient are virtually the same. And then see how this particular construal alters this effect. What is interesting and important is that it doesn't change actually the order of access. It just kind of modulates the probability of accessing the first or the second or the third. But we will get back to kind of summary of results in greater detail. For now, in access order analysis for member of particular pair, so labeling does not really affect order of first entrance into interest area. It only kind of stresses out or makes it less pronounced, less probable to be accessed in particular order. So it just kind of modulates rather than really changes things. Despite the difference in order of mention, which is of the order of magnitude between 750 and 1000 milliseconds after image onset, the basis, the gist is already extracted. We do not store everything and experience is too rich. What is retained seems to be a conceptual message. And this guest message guides our first entrance in particular order. And we can conclude that it essentially mirrors relations in C. So what was found is irrespective of language, participants relied on sequence of quick fixations to extract the gist of a scene in absence of specific cues. They just proceed to they were proceeding to the agent and finally to the patient, or for different control, you have different order of access. But these gazes are linguistically driven, but again, as I said, not really completely changed, but just modulated. So your gazing is adjusted to what you hear, but not completely changed. And the point here is also 1 second after hearing a sentence, It seems that the effect of construal on order becomes less and less visible, or as we said, almost invisible. You just, as we said, irrespective of whether you hear active or passive sentence, you keep the gist, you forget the details, you forget the fact that you hear that in passive voice, and then that gist of the message, which is kind of the same for active and passive, so the semantics is, let's say the message is the same, you will be kind of slightly modulated in your eye movements, or your eye movements would be slightly modulated. Our second analysis was on fixation duration. So now we had time variables. This was just the order of access. And now we have, well, we could say that these are more fine-grained dependent variables because typically they're in milliseconds. The model is simple in the sense that you don't need any kind of atypical or less typical link function. You can just use normal or Gaussian. And we run analysis for gaze and total fixation durations. So again, it's called first run gaze duration, which means I will sum up all fixations, durations of all fixations before my eyes leave this interest area for the first time. In total fixation, I will just sum up everything, each and every fixation that is on that given interest area will come into this sum. And the question is, again, does construal manipulation alter the duration of fixation? So in the first part with order of access, we said, can it alter the order in which we visit those critical or interesting interest area? Durational measures, the question is slightly different. Can it alter the time we spent in that given interest area? So for example, if you hear a passive sentence, you could say, well, maybe then you will spend more time on the object, something like that. And summary of results, again, for prepositions, atypical description attenuates longer fixation on more movable items observed in typical and natural viewing mode. For voice, longer fixation in both active and passive than in natural mode. So it's a general elongation. It seems to be more complex when you hear a sentence for the same visual scene, you spend more time with it. Almost like you need to integrate information from different modalities, what you hear and what you see. There is a fixation duration climb, longest duration for agent, then for patient, and finally for event. In dative, you have longer fixation both NP and PP than in natural mode. Again, very similar to what we have in voice, where we observe the same longer duration for active and passive, more complex, richer information, more heavier load, so to say. And then fixation duration climb from object, less to agent, and then finally to recipient. This is how these are kind of summary results presented visually. We also see there is a considerable difference in total time spent. So it seems that data needs least time in comparison with other two. But the difference between, I would say that it's data, then preposition, and finally voice, but probably the difference between voice and prepositions is not so heavily pronounced. And we also can see that there are some differences in, let's call it consistency of measure, because you see confidence intervals, same as here, and they're pretty much quite similar for prepositions and voice, but almost no variation for data. So participants and items in case, because we control for both items and participants as random effects, you don't see much of a variation at all. So the second part of results for the first run gaze duration, again, just keep in mind, that this is before I my eyes leave the interest area for the first time. So you just sum up this, the first one, as the name says. So we can say there are complex pattern for preposition conditions. Atypical phrasing affects gaze duration. Longer first gaze to book and shorter to phone, for example. It seems that things are made more or less salient by construal. Again, more of a modulation that really changing things completely. There are no significant differences between pairs of voice and data manipulation. No aspects of seeing that attract first gaze for longer time and are made more salient by construal. Finally, the third part of analysis is total gaze duration. Again, that would sum up even those fixations when you return to that interest area from some other place. Sum of all, as I said, sum of all fixations, total length of time spent in that given interest area, or that is almost kind of a measure of total processing effort, with the idea that the longer the total time means that you actually had you made a greater effort for processing. This is just for your information, the typical mean fixation duration in millisecond in seeing perception is between the 250, let's say, and 350 milliseconds, roughly. It's again, it differs given the task. And I can tell you just that you have shorter fixations for silent reading, somewhat longer for reading aloud. In principle, in average, even longer for scene perception and relatively wide range of greater variability for visual search. So depending on exactly what you're looking for, or what's your question, and again, what's your depending variable, you will have a different variability and different mean duration. Also depending that silent reading, reading aloud, seeing perception, search, etc. So results for total fixation duration, some results resemble to those of first fixation duration, like preposition and dative, and then some are different. Voice reveal only difference in a longer fixation for two conditions with sentences, both active and passive, but no difference between two of those. So nothing. For prepositions, a bit more in detail, atypical description attenuates longer fixation, more movable item observed in typical and natural viewing mode. In dative, longer fixation for both noun phrase and prepositional phrase than in natural mode. Fixation duration client is now object and agent and finally recipient. And these are results pretty much the same. You see a little bit wider confidence intervals and less difference across interest areas. And again, very similar, very short or much shorter total fixation duration in comparison with other two types of construal. This is just to show you heat maps of naturalistic, let's say canonical and non-canonical construal. And the more red, the longer, that implies that the fixation is longer. And all those that are marked show some kind of a cross or inter-participant tendency to fixate at those given points. So these are our interest areas, so to say, picture and bed, and for voice, patient, action, and for voice, we also saw the main effect of interest area, patient and action looked longer than agent. And this is the image for passive voice. Just as an example, this is again preposition, Again, you can see some differences. In particular, I would say that these differences are kind of more pronounced. And between these two, you see a little bit more pronounced, because here it's it has this tendency to be longer here than here, and longer here than here. For time analysis, generally speaking, we can say that labeling affects well time, duration. As predicted, we see kind of effect, but for preposition, we see some for prepositions, then for dative, and then for voice, especially in total time. What is interesting is that active and passive do not differ significantly from each other, and there is only weakly longer viewing duration for voice versus naturalistic viewing. So both active and passive are slightly longer than just natural scene perception. Again, also what we find interesting is that prepositions, those durations mirror construal, and we can say that language modulates salience of elements in scene. It has, as I already said, highlighting for function rather than complete altering function. And in fact, not uniform, it interacts with construal. It can be more or less pronounced. So going back to our hypothesis, we had this strong claim, which we actually didn't find, but we had a lot of support for weak hypothesis. If construal affects conceptualization, then order of mention modulates scan path and property of eye movements. Again, we see that there is another type of kind of more general Klein. If we think about three types of construal in three columns, and then three different dependent variables in rows, we see that order of access show modulations by preposition and voice, not so much for dative. We have also effect of preposition on first gaze duration, and to some extent to overall gaze duration or total fixation time, but not so much for voice and dative. So we see some kind of effect. It seems that preposition has the strongest effect, then voice speaking generally, and finally dative. In conclusion, the order of access is unaffected, so we didn't change, we didn't start looking different interest area because of, let's say, sentence priming. The gist, the meaning is extracted, and this rule does not seem to affect fixation order, which is also to be expected if you think perception is really robust and potentially it might be harmful, let's say biologically speaking, that things like, let's say this is a kind of a lateral a fine-tuning information channel. If that channel would completely change what I perceive, that might be even dangerous in certain situations. We should not have that, because perception, we should believe our eyes. That's almost like the point. But importantly, language can change these in finer details. Going back to the point from previous slide that Dagmar explained, this is again, although there are traces in perceptual memory and they can persist for a shorter period of time, we cannot communicate with long-term memory what is already gone, in the sense that if we keep the gist, that gist will communicate with long-term memories. So it's stored information rather than details and specifics of whether active or passive sentence was used. Effect of construal interacts with in fascinating ways with naturalistic scene viewing tendencies. And our initial discussion of this, let's say, a chain of effect or aspects that co-affect one another between language and perception and how we conceptualize our reality seems to be very, very interesting and intricate. Question also remains as a kind of longer term question and something for the future is that whether this is just like a stylistic device. All those differences are there is a possibility to say those differences are just a matter of style. An alternative would be that the extent to which perception is affected by differences between particular options. And I think I'm just right on time.